And welcome to all of you to what I know is going to be an interesting and inspiring lecture from our young scholar and attorney. Mr. Ronimo was here for the opening of the exhibit across the hall in the Della Brown Taylor Hardman Gallery, and that was in February. And so it's certainly appropriate to have you back for the closing, which will occur in a few days. For those of you who have not yet had the opportunity to visit the Marching Toward Justice exhibit, it will remain open this evening and throughout the day tomorrow. So if you haven't seen it, please take an opportunity to visit it tonight following Mr. Ronimo's speech. As a matter of fact, at the end of this program, we will not have a Q&A session, but you can join Mr. Ronimo at a reception right outside here for any discussion that you would like to follow up with her. Let me introduce her, and it's my pleasure. It's my second time being with her and in her company, and I'm so honored and happy to introduce her, even though I told her when I saw her, you're not an attorney, you're not more than 12. She's such a youthful-looking young woman. Ms. Geronimo Issi India is the director of the Damon J. Keith Law Collection of African American Legal History. She was previously an attorney for the Racial Justice Program at the American Civil Liberties Union National Legal Department, where she was the Marvin N. Karpatkin Fellow. She has been involved in litigation and advocacy surrounding affirmative action, racial profiling, and challenges to the school-to-prison pipeline. She co-wrote a report on the use of police in schools, which provides a model governance document for schools that have relationships with law enforcement agencies. Geronimo has also clerked for the Constitutional Court of South Africa and previously served as a law clerk to our most famous alum, Honorable Damon J. Keith of the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth District. And some of you may have had the pleasure of hearing him speak on Founders Day. Prior to this, she clerked for Honorable Robert L. Carter in the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York. She received her J.D. cum laude from Fordham University School of Law and her B.A. from Emory University. Before entering law school, she was the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute Fellow at Harvard University and a teacher for Yonkers Public Schools in New York. Please welcome Ms. Geronimo.
Good evening. Thank you, Dr. T, for that introduction. I remember my time with you here when I was here just a few weeks ago, and you really represented, along with several others, the graciousness that I've experienced at Virginia State University. So thank you again. I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here today to talk to you about a subject that I feel very passionately about. I want to thank Dick Wolf for organizing this event. We've been in correspondence with each other over the last couple of weeks, trying to put everything together, and I'm really thankful for his efforts. I also want to thank President Carter for supporting this event and allowing it to move forward, as well as the Arts and Humanities Council. Tonight's event coincides with the closing of the Marching Toward Justice exhibition at West Virginia State University, which has been at the Della Brown Gallery, as Dr. T mentioned, since April 14th, and which will be closing on February 15th, and it will be closing on April 15th. The Marching Toward Justice exhibit is a historic retelling of the history of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution and the fight for equality in the United States. The Marching Toward Justice exhibit has traveled consistently for over 10 years now and has gone to over 40 states around the country, providing an opportunity for thousands to learn about the fundamental importance of the 14th Amendment and our nation's ongoing quest to realize the high ideals of the Declaration of Independence. It brings to life stories about how persons of African descent in North America and their advocates have struggled for justice. Marching Toward Justice begins in 1619 with the arrival of captive Africans in English colonial America and ends in 1957 with the admission of 9 African-American students to Central High in Little Rock, Arkansas. It offers you the opportunity to share the centuries-long struggle for justice, the shared experiences of African roots, the Middle Passage, servitude, slavery, racism, and the resistance forced the new African-American people. This exhibition focuses on the 14th Amendment to the Constitution and the struggle to make America a true democracy. The 14th Amendment was added to the Constitution in 1868, but it was not enforced for African-Americans and other minorities until the late 20th century. The 14th Amendment established the definition of citizenship for all Americans. It prohibits states from interfering with federally recognized and guaranteed rights. The 14th Amendment ultimately became the weapon of choice for African Americans and their allies in the struggle to attack the legal foundation of institutionalized racism and the concept of separate but equal. Tonight, I'm going to discuss the continued need for the 14th Amendment. And before I start our discussion, I want to start off by a quote by Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King that we should keep in mind as we think about the 14th Amendment. And that quote goes as follows. Cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe nor politic nor popular, but one must take it because it is right. Now first, I'm going to start by providing an overview of how the 14th Amendment came into being in the first place. Then I will talk about how it actually became enforced and actually was realized. Finally, I'm going to leave off with current discussions about the concerning the continued relevance of the 14th Amendment and why that amendment is relevant in light of ideals articulated in the Declaration of Independence and the obligations that the U.S. has under international law, particularly in relation to the elimination of racial discrimination. I want to start by painting a picture of the country when the 14th Amendment was enacted. It was 1868, and the Civil War had just ended 3 years prior. It was the Reconstruction period of the United States, and white lawmakers and citizens began to focus on the needs of the 4 million newly emancipated men, women, and children in the U.S. In 1865, just a few years prior, the 13th Amendment was ratified, abolishing the institution of slavery. However, there was still on the books a Supreme Court decision from 1857, Dred Scott v. Sanford, which held that blacks were not citizens of the United States and not entitled to the same privileges that citizens enjoyed. Dred Scott, a black man, sought to determine the legal status of a slave who traveled to and resided in a free state or territory. In 1857, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear Scott's argument. The court told Scott that there were no rights held by a Negro any white person was obligated to respect. The 14th Amendment was an opportunity to reverse this decision and ensure that blacks would enjoy citizenship rights. In many respects, the 14th Amendment was a mechanism for making the high ideals articulated in the Declaration of Independence reality. The Declaration of Independence states, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." The 14th Amendment embodies this spirit. The actual text of the 14th Amendment states, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the states wherein they reside. In addition, it forbids states from denying any person life, liberty, or property without due process of law, or to deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws." By directly mentioning the role of the states, the 14th Amendment greatly expanded the protection of civil rights to all Americans. The U.S. Senate passed the 14th Amendment on June 8, 1866, by a vote of 33 to 11 senators, while the U.S. House of Representatives passed the 14th Amendment on June 13, 1866, by a vote of 120 to 32 representatives. On July 28, 1868, Secretary of State William Seward issued a proclamation certifying the ratification of the 14th Amendment by the states. At the time the 14th Amendment was being discussed, the Chinese Exclusion Act was on the books, and it prohibited persons who were born in the United States but had Chinese parentage from becoming citizens. The 14th Amendment's text states, though, that all persons born and subject to the jurisdiction thereof the United States are citizens. This created an obvious conflict, and some expressed concerns at that time about the amendment's impact on Chinese immigration. In 1898, the Supreme Court had an occasion to actually make a determination about this precise issue. And in its decision of United States v. Wong Kim Ark, the Supreme Court held that children of Chinese immigrants born in the United States were citizens under the 14th Amendment, even though their Chinese-born parents were not eligible for naturalization under then existing law. So this was an express recognition of what we know as birthright citizenship. The 14th Amendment was designed to be inclusive and is in many ways the amendment that captures what this country is about, allowing people to pursue life, liberty, and happiness, a recognition that we are all equal, and a notion of citizenship that was not tied to caste or systems of subordination. Despite the high ideals the amendment embodies, its purposes were not immediately realized. I'm now going to turn to the enforcement of the amendment. Those of you who have already had a chance to visit the Marching Toward Justice exhibition are already aware that the fight to realize the purpose of the 14th Amendment was not easily fought, and it took many years to continue, and it's in many respects still being fought. Following the Reconstruction period, blacks were subjected to a tremendous amount of tyranny by white supremacist groups like the Ku Klux Klan. Black codes were enacted to curtail their citizenship rights, and they faced racial intimidation in nearly all facets of life. At least 1,846 blacks were lynched between 1882 and 1901. The African-American journalist Ida B. Wells' publication, Red Record, did much to reveal the economic and political motives of those who lynched men and women of color under other pretenses. In 1896, the Supreme Court held that Jim Crow, the mandatory segregation of the races, was constitutional in its decision of Plessy v. Ferguson. Thus, blacks who lived in states with Jim Crow laws were faced with not only having their citizenship rights abridged, but also being relegated to separate, inferior facilities from whites. Jim Crow laws spread throughout the South, requiring separation of coloreds and whites in public transportation, hospitals, schools, restaurants, and restrooms. African Americans became accustomed to backdoor takeout windows at restaurants where coloreds were not permitted to sit down and dine. Most assumed that their loved ones would be buried in segregated cemeteries. In Southern courtrooms, spectators were separated by color, and black witnesses were even given a separate Bible upon which to swear. In some workplaces, black employees were not allowed to look out the same windows as their white counterparts. In the face of these conditions, there were many vocal activists who campaigned against Jim Crow and the inequality in the United States. They wanted the 14th Amendment to actually be enforced. Charles Hamilton Houston, a Harvard-trained African-American attorney and Howard University's law school dean, became the NAACP's first special counsel. Houston, who had attended segregated public schools of Washington, D.C., and served in the segregated army during World War I, made no secret of his opposition to oppression and his view that discrimination in education was designed to promote white supremacy. He said that the purpose of any practice or policy of racial inequality was by design and not accident to keep blacks on the bottom. A brilliant strategist and litigator, Houston, relying on the 14th Amendment, developed a legal assault on racial discrimination in education. Under the direction of Charles Hamilton Houston, Howard Law School, a historically black law school in Washington, D.C., blossomed into what has been described as a citadel for black intellectualism. Houston advanced a legal strategy aimed at dismantling Jim Crow in the South. He planned to use law as a tool for eliminating Jim Crow and would use the 14th Amendment, which guarantees equality, as his primary weapon. He took into account entrenched racism, white supremacy, the Supreme Court's deference to legal precedent, its policy of judicial self-restraint, and the need for black community initiative into account. In 1936, Houston invited Thurgood Marshall, one of his former students, to join the staff of the NAACP's special counsel. With the legal committee and courageous African-American attorneys, including Robert L. Carter, William Hasty, George E.C. Hayes, Constance Baker Motley, and others, the NAACP carefully prosecuted test cases to prepare a direct assault on racial segregation in education. Houston and Marshall began, however, at the law school level. Judge Keith, one of West Virginia State's alum, one of the most prominent alum of West Virginia State, attended Howard Law School. And he often talks about his time at Howard Law School and about how he would see Thurgood Marshall and Charles Hamilton Houston during these moot court sessions where they'd actually prepare for their arguments before the Supreme Court. And Howard Law School was really fundamental to the Civil Rights Movement. It was a place where civil rights activists could come together and start to strategize about how they could take apart these Jim Crow laws. Houston's strategy began at the graduate institutional level and ended in primary schools with Brown v. Board of Education. On May 17, 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court held the policy of segregating white and black school children was unconstitutional. On this day, Chief Justice Warren announced for the court, "We conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. We hold that the plaintiffs are deprived of the equal protection of the laws guaranteed by the 14th Amendment in what has been termed as Brown 1, the 1954 decision. It signaled a change in what would be considered constitutional and legally enforceable by courts of law. This case overruled the Supreme Court's prior case of Plessy v. Ferguson, which I mentioned earlier, which found that Jim Crow was actually constitutional. Brown galvanized those who were opposed to inequality and mobilized a large-scale social movement aimed at bringing civil rights for all citizens. With the continued work of those like Thurgood Marshall and Robert L. Carter, both counsel on Brown, and other social activists like Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed. These important legal decisions and determinations and laws illustrate how the 14th Amendment has been used to protect the citizenship rights of all. However, they were and by no means the end of the road. There have been many cases filed under the 14th Amendment since that time, some of which have been successful, others which have not. Now, I want to turn and talk about the current state of affairs and how the 14th Amendment is relevant now in light of recent events and controversies. I'm sure many of you are aware of recent discussions about the continued need for the 14th Amendment and whether states have legal authority to abridge it. This discussion has primarily occurred in the immigration context. Efforts have been adopted to abridge fundamental rights of immigrants, including the right to ethnic education about their history, the right to equality through freedom from racial profiling, and the right to citizenship. The question surrounding citizenship is whether children of undocumented persons or persons in the U.S. on temporary visas should be considered citizens, or in other terms, whether we should still have what is known as birthright citizenship. Some argue that the 14th Amendment, as it is currently drafted and interpreted, encourages foreigners to enter the U.S. illegally and have children who will subsequently be deemed citizens. As U.S. Senator Graham has described it, they come here and they drop babies. Out of frustration over perceived lack of action at the federal level to address immigration concerns, state legislators have begun to take matters into their own hands. The decision acknowledging birthright citizenship, however, was decided in 1868, as I mentioned earlier, and it reflects the language, 1898, as I mentioned earlier, and it reflects what the language of the 14th Amendment actually says. Despite this, the Organization of the State Legislators for Legal Immigration, a national organization of state legislators, announced a national campaign to end the 14th Amendment's guarantee of citizenship for all children born in the United States. They are, in essence, attempting to rewrite the Constitution in an attempt to eliminate birthright citizenship. There are 65 members of this organization, and they span over 40 states. And the organization was founded by Pennsylvania State Representative Daryl Metcalf in 2007. There's been a state compact, an agreement between several state legislators stating that they would try to promote legislation that would actually curtail birthright citizenship. And these states include Alabama, Arizona, Delaware, Idaho, Indiana, Michigan, Mississippi, Montana, Nebraska, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Utah. So far, legislation in South Dakota, Montana, and Arizona have all been shot down, and we're hopeful that other legislation will follow similar course. There have also been efforts to promote legislation that would eliminate ethnic studies in many states. Tuscan Unified School District's Mexican American Ethnic Studies program was declared illegal by the state of Arizona in accordance with a state law which came into effect on January 1st. Tom Horn, Arizona's newly elected Attorney General, declared the program illegal on account of it allegedly
teaching Latino students that are being mistreated, that they are being mistreated, and encouraging students to become activists for their race. This is what he says is unconstitutional and not allowed under Arizona state law. In the capacity of state superintendent of public instruction, Horn had written the law challenging ethnic studies program last year. The bill, HB 2291, was passed by the state legislature in April and signed into law by Governor Jan Brewer in May of 2010. This current debate about the continued need for the 14th Amendment is troubling for a variety of reasons. First, it is contradictory to the spirit and purpose of this nation. The framers of the 14th Amendment were concerned with the creation of tiers of citizenship. They did not want to create a caste system in the United States. They were aware of this possibility, and they took that into account when they were drafting the language of the 14th Amendment and chose to draft language that is naturally inclusive. They created the 14th Amendment with the understanding that it would embody the ideals that were put forth in the Declaration of Independence. It is about, the 14th Amendment is about acknowledging everyone's basic humanity. It's about acknowledging that anyone born here can be a citizen. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and the states are obligated to comply with it. They're obligated to comply with these constitutional requirements, despite how they may feel about it. What is this legislation going to mean? Does it mean that we start racially profiling at hospitals, require parents to show birth certificates before picking up their child? Do we do this to all parents or just those parents who seem foreign? I think you see where I'm going with this, that this can be a very problematic thing. It's going to really result in the creation of another caste system within the U.S. Second, putting aside the constitutionality issues concerning this type of legislation, as I mentioned earlier, this type of legislation is also problematic because it creates a culture of fear among immigrant populations and encourages, if not outright mandates, that segments of the population be subjected to racial profiling. How do you enforce this law unless you're going to racially profile? Third, it is important that we not lose sight of the battle fought by pioneers like Thurgood Marshall to hold states accountable under the 14th Amendment and do what it provides for, which is equal justice under law. As I mentioned earlier, it was a long battle to actually have the 14th Amendment be enforced. We can't lose sight of that. The suggestion that birthright citizenship can be a bridge, or any aspect of the 14th Amendment can be a bridge, should set off alarms to all Americans. The amendment has been instrumental in the elimination of American apartheid, preventing unjust deprivations of life, liberty, and property, and in eliminating various forms of discrimination. This conversation concerning the value of the 14th Amendment places all civil rights at risk. It is essentially a conversation about whether we value rule of law. The rule of law is key in a democratic society, and overturning over 100 years worth of legal precedent and manipulating a constitutional amendment, even when done for what someone perceives as a worthy cause, is contrary to basic principles under rule of law. Having recently spent a few months in South Africa, I'm very sensitive to how law can be used to target populations and institutionalize racial prejudices and racial inferiority, all motivated by fear of the other. While amending the 14th Amendment may not seem as extreme as the enactment of Bantu laws in South Africa, which basically legalized apartheid and provided for the separation of the races, it does provide an implicit recognition that laws can be altered in manners that are politically appealing, even when such alteration would violate basic human rights. Finally, I'd like to spend some time discussing the area that I haven't spent too much time discussing, which is international law. Article 6 of the Constitution establishes that the Constitution and the laws and treaties of the United States are the supreme law of the land. This is important because amending the Constitution in a manner, or amending the 14th Amendment in a manner that promotes racial profiling of segments of the population, namely Latinos, implicates the United States treaty obligations, which states are bound by. These are the supreme law of the land. The Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination is the principal international treaty for the elimination of racism and racial discrimination. It defines racial discrimination as any distinction, exclusion, restriction, or preference based on race, color, descent, or national or ethnic origin, which has the purpose of nullifying or impairing the recognition, enjoyment, or exercise on an equal footing of human rights and fundamental freedoms in the political, economic, social, cultural, or any other field of public life. The U.S. ratified this treaty in 1994 and has legally agreed to be bound by the requirements of it and is obligated to protect and promote equality and non-discrimination. The states are also bound by this treaty and also bound to promote policies that promote non-discrimination. The way that amending the 14th Amendment, as suggested by many state legislators, implicates the U.S.'s treaty obligation is by promoting and implicitly authorizing the racial profiling of immigrant populations, particularly the Latino community. There's no way to enforce legislation that eliminates birthright citizenship without conducting inquiries into parents' legal status. Parents would be required by legal papers to prove their citizenship. Certain segments of the community would be actively targeted in this verification process. Further, this sort of legislation would have a disparate impact on poor and minority communities, which may have more difficulty accessing and being able to have this type of documentation that these states' legislators are suggesting that they should have. In short, changing a constitutional amendment simply because of displeasure with the presence of particular ethnic minorities brings about obvious human rights concerns. States are obligated to comply with this international treaty and should not enact laws that would curtail it. I want to close by acknowledging the real concern of communities as they grapple with what they perceive as ineffective immigration policies. While their frustration may be understandable in some respects, it is important that we do not forget the significance of respecting people's civil rights and human rights. As I reflect on the current debate, I'm reminded of a quote by Judge Keith. "We are a country of laws, not men or women. We should not bend the law to satisfy the whims of politics, despite the human rights implications of such actions." This is a time that I challenge those in states where this legislation is being promoted or those who are in conversations about this question to take a step back and to really take some time to reflect on what is the right thing to do. Thank you. Yeah, I'll be here and I can take any questions.